Have you here. It's nice for all of you tuning in online. I gotta tell you, this is week three in a row, and I'm feeling it. I don't know how Pastor Jim does it. I'm like reaching out for someone to tap in, but it's all right. We're excited. We're ready to go. This is the week after Easter, and as such, we're gonna try to follow it up because, you know, he is still risen. And so just like last week, we're gonna look at another story where Jesus interacts with someone. And if you remember last week, one of the things we talked about was that the risen Jesus never left anyone the same. And so we're going to look at another interaction today. And you know, it's going to feel a little weird because we're going to go back in time in the Jesus narrative, but that's okay. It's one of my favorite passages, so I felt like that's a good place to go. Now, before we start, I felt like I could start with a little bit of a story. I don't know if you noticed this last week, but it got warm for a second, and it got pretty warm for a second this last week, and it got me excited for summer. I was getting ready, I was thinking about summer, and I was getting excited. See, when I was growing up, I got to go off to a lake not too far from here all the time, and I love the lake. I love boating, I love swimming, I wakeboard, I love all that stuff. And I actually try to share it a little bit with my students now today. We like to take them up there and let them get a little bit of that feel. But the nice thing for me is that where I grew up, our college group would do what's called a houseboating trip. And if you don't know what a houseboat is, think of an RV that floats. So that's basically an RV that floats. And so what we do is we drive up to the Sacramento Delta, and we would take about 50 or so college kids and some leaders, and we get a bunch of houseboats, and we tie them all together, and we have a great time. It was always one of the highlights of the summer for me. I love that trip. Except for one year. One year did not go as I hoped, and it all started with a simple prank that went way wrong. See, I had spent the morning swimming, wakeboarding, doing all these amazing things, and I was just wiped out. And so I decided to take a nap on one of our rafts that were floating attached to the houseboat. Now, before you get worried, I had plenty of sunscreen on, so that's not the story. I didn't get burned. But what happened was one of my friends thought, you know what would be funny? We should untie this raft and kind of scream, watch him wake up and frantically try to paddle himself back into the boat. The problem was I was wiped out. And so when they untied me and started screaming, I slept unfazed. And so all their laughter turned to concern as they watched me just float off into the horizon. It was a couple of minutes later, I ended up waking up, and it was only because I ran into some reeds that were coming out of the water, and I found that the boat that once was arm's length away was now just a small dot. And so I began to paddle, but if you know anything about paddling against a current, it was basically impossible with the raft I had, and so I just gave up. I gave up, and I realized my only hope is if someone rescues me. My only hope is if someone rescues me, because I have no chance on my own. Well, thankfully, I saw my family's bright red ski boat driving in the distance, and they were coming closer and closer, and I was thinking, here is someone that's going to rescue me. But they didn't slow down. They actually got faster. When they came close, they turned really hard right in front of me, sending a giant wave of water that now splashed over me before leaving into the horizon. And so now I was stranded and soaking wet, and that's when it hit me. I needed someone else to rescue me. Thankfully, there were other boats, and one of them was much kinder than my dad, and he came and saved me and brought me back. And from that day on, I was now on raft patrol. Anytime someone had a similar idea as my friend and thought, oh, this would be really funny, I not only slapped it out of their hand, I would jump in and make sure no one else had to go through that same fate. See, last week was Easter, and last week was this climax, this pinnacle celebration, celebrating Jesus as the one who rescues. But it shouldn't just be a celebration, it should be something that inspires us as well. And that's kind of where we're going today. We're going to look at a story where someone not only celebrated Jesus, but was inspired by them. See, just like Thomas last week, Thomas, he went off and he left a mark afterwards because he was inspired. Today, we're going to look at someone who was changed and then did something about it. If you have your Bibles, turn to John chapter 4. We're not doing a miracle. We're done with the Better Jesus Is series. but we're still using John one more time, so forgive me. But I think this is important. John chapter 4 is where we're going to be. Let me just help you out to see where we are, because we're going back in time, like I said, so it might be a little confusing. This is after the wedding in Cana, and it's actually right after Jesus has this interaction with a man named Nicodemus, where he's talking about being born again and kind of having this theological, philosophical talk. And so this is after that. Jesus is in Judea, and now he needs to get to Galilee. And so if you could put the map up, Jesus is in Judea, and now he's trying to get to Galilee. And so if you notice, Judea's in the south, Galilee's in the north. And what would normally happen is that if Jews were traveling from one spot to the other, they would take this really long way around. So they would cross the river, they would go into Perea, and they would go all the way around to Galilee. Jesus does something different, though. Jesus takes the straight shot. Jesus goes straight from Judea through Samaria to Galilee. Now, for the early readers, this is supposed to be something shocking. This is supposed to be something that they notice, because that's not normal. That's not cultural. That's countercultural. People didn't just take the straight way across. And Jesus isn't doing this just because it's the fastest way. Jesus, like with many of the miracles, is very intentional. He's trying to do something here. Now, his path isn't traveled because the Jews and the Samaritans didn't get along. They didn't like each other. And it wasn't like a UCLA-USC rivalry kind of like. It was deep-seated. It was rooted in cultural and racial tension. It was serious stuff. The Samaritans, they were a group that was actually formed during the exile. They're made up by the Jews who were left behind, as well as the Assyrian conquerors who came in. And so they're mixed. And because of that, the Jews, they looked down on them. And as you might imagine, the Samaritans, they didn't take too kindly to that. They didn't have any fond feelings toward the Jews as well because of that. And they actually ended up siding against them in the Maccabean revolt when the Jews had a chance to free themselves. And so there's a lot of historical and racial and cultural tension that is in these two groups. So Jesus deciding to go right in between and to go there, that was strange. I bet the disciples probably tried to convince him not to do that. But he's being intentional. He's got something in mind that he wants to do. So they travel through Samaria. They stop at a place called Jacob's Well, and he sends his disciples away. He says, go into the town, get some supplies for us, but I'm going to wait here. I'm going to wait here. It's about lunchtime, so, go grab us some lunch. Jesus waits behind, and when he waits behind, we get this interaction that he was aiming for. Because when he waits behind, there's an interaction where a Samaritan woman comes to the well to fill up her water, and he stops and asks her for a drink. Now, again, for the early readers, this is like flashing red lights. This is like they're stopping, they're wondering. There's probably some gasps in the audience. For us, we kind of miss it. But for them, this is a shock. Jesus is going very countercultural right here. He's very countercultural. He's breaking all the cultural protocols. First off, there was a woman alone at the well in the middle of the day. That's not normal. Usually the women would go all together. They would travel in a pack, and they would go in the morning early when it was light, or when it was light enough but still cool. Not in the hottest part of the day, in the afternoon alone. So this is supposed to alarm us. This is supposed to say there's something off about her. There's something we need to pay attention to. Secondly, Jesus talks to her. Jesus talks to her. He asks for a drink. He talks to her. If you're a Jewish rabbi, it was a kind of an unspoken thing where you don't talk to Samaritans. And you don't talk to women, especially not alone. And so when you put the two together, it's like, okay, this is like the one you really shouldn't do. And yet Jesus talks to her. And what's so amazing is I think the way Jesus talks to her. Because Jesus had all the power in the world. Culturally, he was a Jewish rabbi. He had the power there. He was also God incarnate, so he had the power in the situation, but he doesn't use it. He doesn't try to tip the scales. He doesn't try to instill any power there. Instead, he does quite the opposite. He tries to give it to her. He comes with humility. He comes with gentleness. He tries to create this safe space, this place where they can interact. Still, though, given the historical background, the woman is just completely caught off guard. What? How do you ask me for a drink? You're a Jew. I'm a Samaritan. You're supposed to hate me. I'm supposed to hate you. You can't just get rid of all this cultural hostility in a moment. You can't just forget about it. But I think what we see here, and perhaps why John really wanted to highlight this story, is that Jesus isn't deterred by a few barriers or a few walls that we put up. He crashes through in order to reach us. Take a look at verse 10. That's where we're going to jump in. It's about a quarter of the way into this interaction. Jesus already asked her for water. She's already been kind of shocked by it. And now there's kind of this conversation that's happening. Jesus answers her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw, and this well is very deep. Where can you get this living water from? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from himself, as did his sons and his livestock?" Okay, I didn't do a very good job, but what I meant to do there is kind of give a little sarcastic vibe as I read her lines, because I think there's a little bit of a sarcastic vibe coming here from this Samaritan woman. I think she's very intelligent and she's very witty, and if you remember, she's there alone in the middle of the day, which is supposed to spark some interest and wonder why. And I think if we know from the story a little later on, she's gone through some pain. And she's there because she's gone through some pain. And so now this wittiness and this intelligence has become a defense mechanism. Not only does she question how Jesus is going to draw this living water, I mean, you just asked me for a drink and now you're saying you got something better, but she seems to remark in a strange way to Jesus' comments that he's someone special. I think, sadly, it's probably because there's been many men in her life that have come to her as God's gift to her. And so now when someone is saying the same, she's trying to tell him, you know, you should think again. But Jesus isn't here to use, to abuse, or to take. Jesus is different. He's here to give. And we just celebrated Easter, where Jesus is literally giving himself for us. And so Jesus is doing here what he does. He's coming to give in order that he can rescue. Take a look at verse 13. Continue on. Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't be thirsty again and have to keep coming here to draw water." He told her, "Go call your husband and come back." Kind of strange. She said, "I have no husband," she replied. And Jesus said to her, "You're right when you say that you have no husband. The fact is, you've had five husbands, and the man that you are now with is not your husband. So what you've said is quite true." "Sir," the woman said, "I can see that you're a prophet. Our ancestors worship on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." Okay, stop right there real quick, because there's a lot of back and forth going on, and we probably need to digest it for a moment. So Jesus asked her for water, and then he tells her, you know, you got to actually ask, you should really be asking me, I've got something better. And at first, you know, she replies in the sarcastical, witty kind of way. She's confused. But when Jesus tells her it's like a well that springs up and you'll never be thirsty again, now she's intrigued. Those walls she put up are starting to come down a little bit. She's got to be thinking, oh, that's great. I don't have to come here anymore. I don't have to come here in the middle of the day. I don't have to walk all the way out here, carry all that stuff. Give me some of that water. But the Samaritan woman misses that point of view, that perspective, right? She's got that temporal perspective where, oh, I don't have to walk out here anymore. I don't have to carry this heavy jug. But Jesus is looking at things eternally. That's when Jesus kind of hits her with something out of left field. He says a comment is out of nowhere, right? "Go tell your husband." It seems kind of weird. It feels strange, I think. I would tell you. It felt strange to me, at least. But Jesus is intentional. He's intentional in what he's doing. And so he has this interaction with her where he says, no, you're right. I know that you don't have one, but you've had five, and the person you're with now isn't your husband. And he isn't doing this to shame her or to mock her even. What he's doing is he's saying, I know you. I know who you are. I know you. But as you might imagine, this catches the woman off guard. It catches her off guard. She gets uncomfortable. She changes the conversation. It's funny, I had Jenna, my intern, look at this, and one of the comments she showed me was that the woman doesn't even change the conversation to something like light and friendly. She's not like, oh, lovely weather we're having. She changes the conversation to like, this is getting a little personal. Let's talk politics. That will make things easier. Such a strange way to deflect. But it's an embarrassing moment for the woman. And sometimes it's a little uncomfortable when we interact with these things. But this moment is essential to the story because of who Jesus is and because of who she is. Here's a person with a long list of pain, a long list of broken relationships, a long list of scars. And Jesus is saying that he knows her. He knows her story. He knows the story of defeat. He knows the story of rejection from the community. He knows her. And he's not pointing it out to make fun of her. He's pointing it out to say that I want to break through to the real you. I want to rescue the real you. I don't want to just rescue the you that's keeping me at arm's length. I want to rescue the real you. Earl Palmer, he's one of New Testament scholars, and actually Ken told me just a little while ago, he's one of Ken's favorite New Testament scholars. So now I really have some background for this. Earl Palmer writes on this moment, and what he says is, notice how powerfully and how helpfully Jesus is able to move in to our real selves. The ancient barriers here of nations and religions and traditions do not keep him out. So what Jesus is doing is he's breaking down her walls. He's breaking down this feeling to keep him at arm's length. He's breaking down these walls and filters and all the barriers we hide behind as well so that he can rescue us. I think in doing so, he's actually making this living water so much sweeter. It's so much sweeter, right? It's not this fake thing anymore. It's something sweeter that he's offering. Still, it's uncomfortable, and the woman deflects, right? She says, you know, what about these politics? And Jesus is interesting because he's able to move her back into where he's going in a way that's loving, in a way that answers her question as well. He's saying, you're so worried about the where. Let's get into the who. And so once again, he's breaking through these barriers. Skip ahead just a few verses. Look at verse 25. I think in verse 25, we kind of now get this next element where these barriers are being broken, and now we kind of see some change happen. Verse 25 says, the woman says, I know that the Messiah, called the Christ, is coming. And when he comes, he will explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, the one speaking to you, I am he. The woman is saying, someday our rescuer is going to come. Someday someone's going to come and he's going to set everything right. This rescue is coming. What's crazy is Jesus says it's me. And he does it in a way where it's not a parable, it's not a miracle. He just tells her it's me. He declares it. That's not very Jesus, actually, in these stories. Right? He just actually had an interaction with a Pharisee, Nicodemus, and he didn't even declare himself as the Messiah to him. But here, to this woman, of all people, a Samaritan, he reveals himself. Verse 27, just then his disciples returned, and they were surprised to find him talking with a woman, but no one asked, what do you want? Or why are you talking with her? It's good to know they knew better. Then, leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and said to the people, come. See a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? They came out of the town and made their way towards him. Okay, so the woman comes to the well in order to do a job, right? She wants to fill her water and take it back. But now she has this interaction with Jesus, and it's so influential in her life that she forgets what she's doing. She leaves her water behind, and she goes back into the town. And I think what this shows us is that she believes in Jesus. She believes he's the Messiah. If she didn't, she probably would have just finished the conversation, went about her day, and went home. But no, she left everything behind. And what she does afterwards, I think, is everything. I think it's that next step, that follow-up of Easter. Because just like Thomas, the Samaritan woman doesn't sit on her new life. She doesn't sit on this good news. She goes and does something about it. It says that she went back into her town. Now, the woman went to the well in the middle of the day because she had been rejected by this town. She had been looked down upon. She had been shamed. But here, after experiencing something better, after experiencing something more, something that covers her shame, she goes right back to those people. No longer is she hiding. Now she's running to them. I think it's just so amazing because when she does that, she now impacts the world around her. She impacts her whole community around her. And actually, we get to see her impact. John leaves in the impact that she has. It's a few verses later because Jesus talks to his disciples a little bit and kind of explains some things, but John doesn't end the story. In verse 39, if you skip ahead a little bit more, we get this follow-up of what happens after the woman goes back into her town and tells people about the interaction she just had with Jesus. Verse 39 says, "Many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did. So when the Samaritans came with him, they urged him to stay with them, and he stayed 2 days. And because of his words, many more became believers. They said to the woman, 'We no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we have heard for ourselves, and we know this man really is the Savior of the world.'" This woman has a major impact on her town just by going and pointing people to Jesus. She impacts her entire town. And you know what's crazy is up until this point in the Jesus story, the two biggest witnesses for Jesus, in history up until that moment, really, have been John the Baptist and now the Samaritan woman. Verse 39, many Samaritans believed just because of her testimony. And I think that gets to our big idea, our follow-up of Easter, the thing that we need to kind of take next after the celebration of Christ is risen is this inspiration. And the big idea is this: rescued people, rescue people. Rescued people, rescue people. Now, if you're filling in on your notes, I think that's like number 5. You're filling in your notes, you fill in number 5, you'll notice number 6 has this like dot, 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 by. That's because the next part of this phrase is pretty important. It's rescue people by pointing to Jesus. Rescue people by pointing to the true rescuer, who is Jesus. In a literal sense, the Samaritan woman isn't actually giving salvation to anyone, right? She's not the true rescuer. That's Jesus. We just sang about him. We just did Easter. We celebrate. He's the only one. But what she is doing is she's not just simply sitting on the good news. She's taking her life-changing experience and now sharing it with others. And she's not just telling people about Jesus. She's actually bringing them to Jesus so that they can experience him for themselves. I think that's the real beauty of this story, right? The Samaritan woman doesn't become some superhero after she meets Jesus. She's not flying around rescuing people from burning buildings or anything crazy like that, right? She doesn't become this true rescuer. But what she does is she's simply a person who points people to Jesus. And that right there changes everything around her. She impacts her whole world and beyond just by doing that. You know, I often get asked, what made you want to do youth ministry, work with students and stuff like that? And I think it really comes back to my freshman year in high school, specifically with my baseball team. When I was a freshman in high school, I tried out for the baseball team, and I went to a really big public school. It was actually one of the best teams in the country, and so I feel like it was a miracle that I made the team, truth be told. But I think looking back, it was because God was at work and he was going to do something. And it wasn't me hitting a home run that he was going to do. He was going to do something larger. See, even if I didn't want it to happen, I think God was going to be at work in a similar way that he was with the Samaritan woman. Now, it might surprise you because I'm literally up here right now speaking in front of people, which I know is a fear of a lot of people's, but I'm actually an introvert. And in high school, I was definitely an introvert. And so my goal when I made the team was to keep my head down and make just enough plays to keep myself on the team going forward. But I think God had some other plans, and he began to make it abundantly clear even when I didn't want it. See, you know, I had grown up in the church. I was a pastor's kid, and I hear all the stories, and I hear like, oh, you got to invite people to church and invite them to youth group and all that stuff. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. I just don't want these guys here. Like, you know, do you know many freshman boys? We got some good ones. Caleb's here. But for the most part, you know, they're punks. And these kids were definitely punks. And so I was like, yeah, that's great. Like, I just don't want them in my small group. Like, I'll find some other people. But I think God gave me a few kicks in the butt. And one of them that I vividly remember was that after practicing together for a few months, we have opening day, and it's a big ceremony, and there's all this great stuff, lots of fans, and we're sitting in the dugout kind of waiting for the umpire to get things started. And I don't know if you know anything about baseball players, but they're super superstitious. They're very superstitious. And so one of the players is like, hey, let's get the pastor's kid to lead like a little group prayer before we get started. This caught me off guard because he's not a Christian. He just wanted some bonus points with the guy upstairs before a big game. But, you know, I didn't enjoy being put on the spot, but what was I going to do at that point? It was kind of too late. And so we kind of huddled together. We do a prayer, and it's, you know, not my best. But that was the moment. The crazy thing is, though, we ended up winning that game, and we won it in a miracle-style walk-off, where you win in the last inning and there's some craziness and then the crowd's going wild and the dugout's going wild. And if you know any baseball players, right, they're superstitious and they don't want to change their socks after a win. And so you better believe they weren't going to change any pre-game rituals right there. And so every single game it was, all right, let's huddle together and let's lead a prayer right before. I'm number 5, I think. Yeah, that's me. And so it was crazy. Here's a group of freshmen in high school, baseball players. No one's Christian, but here we are grouping together, praying before every game. And I think really it was more of a routine than anything. It probably didn't make that big of an impact. But what it did do was it gave me kind of a kick in the butt. It kind of reminded me, okay, I can't just be the person that does this. I need to actually live a certain way, and I need to point people to Jesus. And so what happened as the year kind of closed out, I invited 5 of them that I was really close with to come to one of our youth ministry events and to come see it. And they loved it, of course, because we do a good job, okay? Keep in note, students, we do a good job. It's worth inviting people. But they loved it, and so we invited them to camp. They went to camp, and that was kind of the bring them to Jesus himself moment. It wasn't just hearing the stories. Now it was kind of experiencing it for themselves. And it's crazy, that camp, everything changed. These people, I think, would tell you they really experienced something different there. And they came home and they got baptized that summer. And there was some real stuff happening. But that's not the end of the story, right? Because the big idea is rescue people, rescue people, right? Rescue people, rescue people. It didn't end there. There was this multiplication impact that all of a sudden happened. They went out and they started living a certain way, and they started bringing people, and they started sharing stories, and they started telling people, oh, here's why I look different, here's why I talk different, here's why I do all these things. And all of a sudden, by our senior year, our small group went from 2 people when I first joined to 25 people. It was crazy, 25 people. And just a few years ago, actually, the funny thing was I flew home from college, and I found out our coach just got baptized. Our freshman coach got baptized, and he kind of said it was because he noticed a change in all these people. And so it was weird. I was talking with one of the other ones, and we just started to kind of like count out this multiplication aspect of where people went and brought their families and brought their other friends, and there's all these people that I didn't even know And we found it was like 100 people, 100 people in the church now just because, just from those five people. It was this idea that rescue people by pointing to the real rescuer, right? I literally did nothing. I tried to do nothing, in fact. I didn't want them there, okay? I didn't. And yet the real rescuer was at work. And these things just keep happening, right? These things happen. And so kind of that's where we're leading to. Our challenge, our response of Easter is this: rescue people. And they do it by pointing to the real rescuer. There's so many, but what about, but why not? Here's the thing. The Samaritan woman was only with Jesus for a few moments. Honestly, how much do you think she really knew? I mean, she had one conversation with Jesus, and yet she was able to impact her entire community. Never underestimate the power of, hey, I know someone. Let me introduce you to them. That's Jenna again. I should have her help me more because I'm getting these great. Never underestimate the power of, I know this guy, and I think you'd like him too. Just rescue people. And so really, I think the challenge and the follow-up of Easter is quite simple, right? It's literally the mission statement of our church. Mission statement of our church. If you don't know, actually, if you're new and you turn in one of those Connect cards, you get a mug, and in the mug is a sticker. And on that sticker is our mission statement. You should grab a sticker. I keep it on my laptop. And that mission statement is this: let's grow to be people that impact our world and beyond. And so I think the challenge for us after Easter is the same as the Samaritan woman. Let's grow to be people that impact our world and beyond. And let's do it in just a very small start. My practical challenge, my call to action for you is this: go home, and this week, all you got to do is write down three names. Not three names you're going to talk to, just three names. And those three names, just pray for them for the week. Just pray for those people for a week and see how that feels and see how that changes. See how that affects the way that you think. And then let's be people who live lives that are inspired by who Jesus is and what he did for us. Because rescue people by pointing them to Jesus. When we point people to Jesus, I think change happens. Let's pray. God, we come before you today on this day where it's a week after Easter, and we still get to celebrate that you are risen because you are still risen even today. But God, I pray that it's today that's now a catalyst to not just sit on that good news, to not just be someone who celebrates it, but also to be someone who celebrates and is inspired by it. God, so just pray that this is a church who lives out our mission statement, who lives out this idea of pointing people to you and seeing the change that happens when we do. And so God, we just humbly praise you. We thank you. And we just ask for your continued blessing for this church and for the people. So pray this in your name. Amen.